Hey everybody, how the hell are you? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, well, you know, there's gotta be some kind of mess on each and every show, so maybe we just got today's mess out of the way already. Again, I'm gonna blame this one on Bill Gates. Damn you, Bill Gates! Yeah, man, his update restarted my computer right at the point where it was supposed to be downloading Fox News and getting ready to play it. So then come Fox News time, nothing. And then for some reason, man, and you know, there's a setting that we gotta fix here, because it's got a thing where if it doesn't hear anything for a sec, it turns all the streamers off. Well, I'll tell you when to stop streaming, you darn contraption, because I don't need you. What if I have to cough a bunch of times and I mute my mic for how many seconds before it stops streaming the damn show out? Nah, that's not okay. Sometimes I'm letting my guests talk and I turn off my microphone so that I won't interrupt him, mostly, or her. And then I space out and forget to turn my mic back on. And there's so much dead air. You guys hear me do that once a week, right? Nah, hopefully not that much. So, I sure hope this Sam Broadcaster isn't going to turn the show off every time I forget to turn my mic back on. Although, that'll be a fine incentive to make sure that little light's glowing yellow, right? Anyway. Good show for you today. Trevor Tim's going to be on. I'm the scum of the earth, you understand, so I can't get Glenn Greenwald to come on the show anymore. That's all right. I don't take it personal just because I'm so damn proud of him and so damn just happy in general for the existence of the work that he's done over the last year or so. Sorry. But Trevor Tim's going to be on, and he's real smart about all this technical stuff. He's one of them legit computer geniuses and, you know, good on privacy and principle and stuff, too. The great Trevor Tim. He's going to be on the show, and what he's going to do is he's going to talk about what's new in the Greenwald book. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to read the entire Greenwald book. Then I'm going to read the Anand Gopal book. But first, I am going to read the entire damned Greenwald book, and then I'm going to keep emailing him until he finally does the damn show. And I'll guilt trip him into it by saying, look, man, how many of your interviewers actually read the book and took the notes? Come on. Please. That's what I'll do. I'll go to causes.com and I'll have everybody sign a petition begging Greenwald, please. And then he'll do my show and I'll interview him about this stuff. Wouldn't that be great? Number 6 says use Edcast. Well, what the hell do I know, man? All I know how to do is fail to get Greenwald on the show. I sure as hell don't. I was using Winamp. Like it was still 2002 in the Chaos Garage. This Sam, it's kind of a pain in the ass, but it seems kind of all right, too. Edcast, I don't know. Somebody call Ed, have him come over to my house and install the damn thing and make it work right, and I guess I'll switch to Edcast. Otherwise, forget it. Also, Brendan O'Neill's going to be on the show. I really like Brendan O'Neill, and man, he's great on the goddamn problems going on in Nigeria. And some girls got kidnapped. That's a headline, but that ain't the story. You want the story, Brendan O'Neill's got it. Of course, it's all America's fault. Don't be an idiot. Everything is America's fault. The U.S. government, that is. You know, happily posing as the society itself. Though that's not quite the case. But anyway, and you know, O'Neill, he's I guess based there in London, England. And so his spin is, it's all Cameron and the UK government's fault. Yes, they happily pose as the people of the British Isles. The same way the American government pretends to be America. Poor guys. But anyway, so we'll get his truthful, honest, objective, that is anti-American, anti-British take on the horrible war. Which, in a way, you could look at it probably like it's just getting going now, even though it's been going on for so long, compared to what's coming there in Nigeria. And why not? Ask David Brooks. Ask Fred Barnes and William Crystal. They'll tell you, what we need is a big project for to build national greatness. Something that you can believe in. And you know what's big? Nigeria. Hey, what if we just picked a fight in Nigeria? We could have a war there. That'll give the army something to do. Boy, the army is pissed that the Navy and the Air Force get to have a pivot to Asia, a pivot to Russia. Well, what about them? Who do they get to kill? Ah, Africans. First, we'll train up all their militaries, then we'll set them all at war against each other, and then we'll set about redrawing all the lines and claiming everybody's stuck on the wrong side of all the lines, and then we'll all help you kill each other more, and we'll sell lots of bombs and boats and helicopters. And M4 assault rifles. Don't worry, they mean well. Isn't it great watching this? I don't know. It is great. I defend that statement that I just sort of blurted out without really thinking. It is great in a way. It's beautiful in that kind of terrible masterpiece sort of a way, right? Where they can have an entire full-scale invasion of Africa going on. As Ron Paul always says, you can either accept our dollars or our bombs, but you may not be independent from the empire. We're coming. And so if you're cooperative, that just means that we take over your military and train them up and control your officers and take over your government, create a dictatorship, steal all your resources, all that basic imperialism 101 kind of stuff. And then if you're a problem, then we'll just support your neighbors against you or the revolutionaries inside your government. Or maybe we'll just split off the South from your North or whatever it is, the West from your East. And you know what? The politically correct whiners are absolutely right about the falsehood of the map of the world. And even of the round globe. The truth is, Africa is like 14 times the size of Greenland or something. It's huge. There's a gigantic continent. They call it the Dark One, as though it's just inviting the bringing on of the light in the form of the Joint Special Operations Command. To, you know, teach them to elect good men and bring them Christianity and secure their resources for the future national interests of the national security of the thing. And all this can be going on. All that Nick Turse has written and exposed about the American invasion of Africa. And at the same time, TV says, oh, boo-hoo, missing girls. You know, we got a memo from the State Department, and it told us to tell you, boo-hoo, they care so much all of a sudden about 200 girls. Yeah, really. Like the 200,000 little girls they murdered in Iraq. They care about the 200 that have gone missing in Nigeria. Doesn't anyone ever on any of these TV shows ever just say, give me a break, man. Don't tell me the U.S. government cares about anyone except themselves and their cronies, missing little girls. Of a darker race, too. I mean, they're concerned about it for Twitter points and PR purposes, maybe. But in real life, it's like that episode of The Family Guy where they think that it's a little white girl that died in the bus crash, and all the reporters are like, oh my God, really? What was her name? What was her name? And they say, oh, it was Melissa. And they go, uh-huh. And he says, Gutierrez. And they go, oh, yeah, right. Like, they care about a dead little girl named Gutierrez. Yeah, sure. But, oh, they really care about 200 missing girls in Africa. Land of the child soldier armies, right? No, there's nothing you need to know about the background of American intervention in Africa. There are no interests at stake. There are no ulterior motives. There are no previous interventions which have created any consequences leading to our current situation that you need to be aware of. In fact, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and cancel the Brendan O'Neill interview because, you know, I'm sure whatever's going on over there is on the up and up, right? I mean, hey, we're talking about the American Empire. All right. I'll tell you what, I'll leave you with these two quotes. These are my two favorite AFRICOM quotes so far. The first is from the New York Times. With the United States military out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan, the Army is looking for new missions around the world. Quote, as we reduce the rotational requirements to combat areas, we can use these forces to great effect in Africa, General David M. Rodriguez, the head of African Command, told Congress this year. And then the other one is from DefenseNews.com. At Fort Riley, the Dagger Brigade is deploying to Africa because they're looking for ways to stay globally engaged. Their needs come first, mission second. Self-licking ice cream cone. Simple as that. Expand the empire for its own sake. You know, the other thing was, as Eric Margulies pointed out, there was a giant landslide in Nigeria. Did you guys see the pictures of that? It made the absolute horrific catastrophe in Washington State last month, or 2 months ago, last month, right? Pale in comparison, and not to really pale it in comparison. But this thing in Nigeria, they had a mudslide that wiped out an entire village, killed more than 1,000 people. Where's the emergency response for that? Where's JSOC with their shovels digging to save those people? Where are your crocodile tears there? Oh, no excuse for a military invasion in your mudslide? Onto your kidnapping then. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything, sir. Now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Rad, I forgot that was in the rotation. All right, I think for the rest of the show, I'm just going to play Bum Rush the Show. Oh, man, all right. Oh, no, that's... Takes a Nation, Money Souls back anyway. You know? All right, so I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Brendan O'Neill and Trevor Tim coming up. Hey, let me say here that if you're a fan of this show, then that means you got to be a fan of Eric Garris and Justin Raimondo and Jason Ditz and Margaret Griffiths and Angela Keaton and the people over there at antiwar.com, which pretty much does include me. I mean, I've been laid off there, but I'm actually the editor anyway, basically. I think. So it still includes me there at antiwar.com. I still consider me part of we. No? I don't know. Kinda. Anyway, antiwar.com is great, and a world without antiwar.com would really suck. And the problem is that the economy sucks. And the other problem is that liberals and leftists, I mean, even the hardcore ones, man, they don't care that much about the empire when Democrats are in power. It's just as simple as that. And the kind of support that antiwar.com used to be able to count on, it's just not there anymore. And then on top of that, and this is really the reason that I got fired. On top of that, there was a guy who, through the Freedom of Information Act, found documents about an FBI investigation of antiwar.com. And when that became, and the ACLU is now suing them because they were breaking the law. They were illegally surveilling antiwar.com on the basis of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act under the FISA warrant threshold of evidence. They had a long-term investigation of antiwar.com, and antiwar.com's donors, this is not the best pitch I've ever done, I guess, but it's the truth. They speculated and wondered, who might be funding antiwar.com, mostly just as an excuse to keep investigating, I think. Nobody really believed that Garris and Raimondo were agents of a foreign power or anything like that. It was just their excuse. But when this came out, what it meant was some serious donors to antiwar.com. And that doesn't mean, you know, George Soros billionaires. It just means people who were able to, you know, maybe a couple of millionaires, that kind of thing. Their support dried up. And to roughly paraphrase each and every one of them, I'm sorry. I cannot knowingly give y'all money when the FBI is looking into who's giving y'all money. And I got a wife and a family and a mortgage and obligations, and that's it. I'm sorry. Please forgive me for my cowardice, but it is what it is. That's what they all said. And of course, they're all forgiven. It's not their fault. It's the FBI's fault. It's the American police state's fault. Antiwar.com is actually the first example. The ACLU is great. Was very excited when they heard this. Finally, Marcy Wheeler, of course, broke it all down. She can just X-ray vision through all of those documents and tell you exactly what they say and what they mean, and determine immediately that yeah, look, here's what they did. Here's the first time that we can prove that they used their Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act powers against American journalists. And so, antiwar.com's revenue and budget was slashed to little pieces, and so. I'm not complaining about being mostly a volunteer there now because I really believe in the work. Justin is still, after all this time and despite some disagreements, is still my favorite columnist. And so I'm still happy to work on his columns and I'm still happy to help with the entire site. It's the most important thing in the world. So that's my part. Your part is to go to antiwar.com/donate and donate. If you really got piles of money, then you can stop by scotthorton.org/donate and donate here too. In fact, if you want to write it off on your taxes, you can donate to me by donating to them and saying this is to go to Scott Horton, and they'll send it on that way if you're interested in that. But, you know, I would appreciate your support for them as much as I would appreciate your support for me. Even though your support for them does actually benefit me a little bit, that's not the real point. The real point is we absolutely have to keep Eric and Angela and Justin and Jason and Margaret showing up to work or we're screwed. That's it. We got to have antiwar.com. Are you kidding me? Think about it. If there was no more antiwar.com, what the hell happened to antiwar.com? Dude, they just ran out of money. There's nobody willing to support it. It's a meager budget. 100 grand a year or something. Whatever the hell it is. 200 a year. Couldn't keep it going. Now there's no antiwar.com. Can you imagine a world like that? And it sounds stupid. I don't mean to be all hyperbole and threatening you, but this is starting to sound like some horrible, you know, national public radio thing. I don't mean to just keep flogging you over the head with it, but it would really be problematic if antiwar.com didn't make it. And you know what? I'm sorry you don't have a Republican to fear. And you know what? I acknowledge that yes, John McCain would have killed all of mankind in a thermonuclear war with Russia by now. But that doesn't make Obama good. And doesn't make his dead body pile corpses any lower than it really is. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria. And now, and Robert Perry might let him off the hook for it, but it seems to me like it's the President of the United States who has gotten us into such trouble right now with Ukraine. And just like John McCain is actually risking war with Russia. I mean, it doesn't take much to do the thought experiment, and I'm not the kind of alarmist who's always saying, you know, be afraid and buy my crap and whatever. I'm not trying to do that. But all that has to happen is some, you know what? Put it this way. Some of the anti-Nazis in the East do something really, really horrible to the right sector Nazis. And then the rest of the right sector Nazis and the Svoboda Party and the Kiev Putsch regime fight back harshly, and the thing devolves into a real ass civil war where the fighting aged males on both sides are now lining up. That's it, we're going to war now. That could happen this week. I'm not saying I think it's likely. I'm not trying to scream and yell and say run for the hills, but I'm saying, I mean, what's to stop it at this point, other than the lack of power, the lack of actual ability on the part of the Putsch government to attempt to really wage a war against the people of the East, who have now voted to declare their independence, without exactly defining what they mean by that. And not all the ballots were the same in all places, but anyway, if it turned into a real-ass civil war there, then that could very easily mean a full-scale Russian intervention, which could very easily mean them taking all of eastern Ukraine all the way to the port of Odessa and setting up another chain of events to fall in the American confrontation with Russia, with the NATO confrontation with the Russian Federation. And so I don't need to go all slippery slope argument from there, okay? I'm not trying to just sit here and speculate worst case scenario for you. I'm just saying that this is what has happened. This would be like, imagine seriously for a moment, if Russia had regime changed the government in Mexico and Canada. America would go to war with them. That's it. We would absolutely go to war with them. There's just no question about that. They would nuke Moscow. Regime change in Canada. Over 7 billion human beings' dead bodies. Would America allow a regime change in Canada? A civil war against those who wouldn't accept it. Ha! Put it that way for a moment. You know I'm right. That's it. Simple as that. We'd go to war with all of Slavic civilization and wipe them off the face of the earth forever with our H-bombs. And whoever else survived, you know, good luck to us too, if we survived. So, but that's what America's doing in their Canada, their vassal state. And I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying it is what it is. You know, Stephen Kinzer wrote a thing in the LA Times like this the other day, saying, oh yeah, you go on and on about sovereignty, but ultimately the great powers will determine their next door neighbors' governments to one degree or another. They will have influence. To act like this is all Ronchevist, right-wing Putinist, reconquering of eastern Ukraine is a joke. It's simply a reaction to America's regime change in their capital city. As everyone already knows. Sorry, I blew the break again. I always do that. Here's your stupid Fox News, so go to the bathroom, get a drink of water, change lanes. See you in a minute. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, I don't have anything exciting enough to justify anything exciting enough to say to justify that intro, but anyway, can't even say that well. Here, MCA again. He's a lot better at talking than me. Well, was. All right, so today's Glenn Greenwald Day. As I was mentioning, his book is out, and he's got a bunch of excerpts published all over the place, and that's good. Had a great interview with Amy Goodman earlier, where he talked about a lot of the new aspects. As I said, Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the... the hell? Why is this thing so quiet? The Freedom of the Press Foundation is going to be on the show to talk about that a little bit later. And, yeah, so that's good. If anybody wants to call in the show, feel free to call in the show. The number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. You can talk about Greenwald, talk about Snowden, talk about wars, talk about whatever you want. I'm going to talk right now about Rudy Rummel, the author of Democide. He was a professor at the University of Hawaii and a former libertarian turned dingbat. I don't know. Dumbass. Something like that. I hate to speak ill of the dead, but that's really a footnote. He did a lot of great work on the issue of what he called democide, and that was murder of civilians by their own governments. Not, Russian citizens killed by the Nazis, but Russian citizens killed by the Russian government, the Soviet government. Germans killed by the Nazi one. That kind of thing. Chinese killed by Mao. And anyway, he counted all up, and it was something on the order of 175 million people in the last century. 175 million people murdered by their own governments in the last century. And remember now, and this cuts right to, you know, what Rothbard wrote in Anatomy of the State, the very nature of the state. He begins, what the state is not, it is not your security force. It is its own security force. Simple as that. And just like the army invading Africa. Not that they have any reason to invade Africa other than they need something to do. So they have to find a reason to do a thing. And they don't care how many Africans they kill. And they don't care how much blowback it brings on you. Because they're not your security force. They never were your security force. They're your enemies. They're your kidnappers. That's who they are. Occasionally we get to elect who rules our internal prison here, but that's basically the game. As Stefan Molyneux calls it, human farming, right? There's the state and the cronies who are closest to the state and the rest of us who they allow to exist to serve them, basically. And in some enlightened societies, they'll let you have enough freedom that you can be prosperous, all the better to suck off you. In other countries, the governments have shorter time preferences. They'll just go ahead and turn you upside down, shake all the last coins out of your pocket, and drop your body in a ditch, you know. Time preferences, you understand. But anyway, so Rudy Rummel, despite the fact that he ended up believing in Bush's freedom agenda and supporting the Iraq War and the U.S. militarist crusade to create democracy around the world and whatever. I don't know if he was going senile by then or what. But really, it's all to the good as far as I'm concerned, because it just goes to show, it just goes to highlight the evil of the state and the absurdity of siding with it. This state versus that one. And believe me, for, you know, I could totally see someone living through the 20th century and thinking the Americans got the best state out of everybody. If everybody means the Japanese and the Chinese and the Russians and the Germans and the British and all of their conquered helots around the world, then, you know, hey, we're doing something right, man. Remember that time we liberated France from the Nazis? And all of that? It's easy to understand why someone, how someone could talk themselves into believing that. Believing in the Republicans of the George W. Bush years? Believing in the neocons? Believing in their stated motives of spreading democracy around the world? And all of that? I don't know, man. I remember at the time, people thrashing Rummel but good. He even started calling himself a freedomist, so he wouldn't be confused with those evil pacifist libertarians who didn't want to invade, who didn't want to commit the supreme war crime of invading another country and destroying it. Like, the only kind of government murder that's wrong is democide. But starting an aggressive war destined to kill a million people, that's okay, as long as you're just trying to spread democracy. And after all, now that Maliki's in charge of a democracy, that means he'll never get into a war with another democracy. It's like magic. Ah, well, anyway, you should do yourself a favor and familiarize yourself with Rummel's work. And may he rest in peace and all that stuff. Let go my resentment over the his support for the Iraq war at this point, since he's dead and dead as an Iraqi. And since he really did so much great work. And I think at Reason.com, their obituary said that the University of Hawaii will be, well, they still are posting his work. I don't know for how long. Oh, and apparently he died back in March, March 2nd, something like that. I didn't realize. But anyway, so Rudy Rummel, everybody. Author of Democide and couple other books like that. All right. And then, hey, did you see Ehud Olmert is going to prison for 6 years? Nah, come on. They're going to suspend his sentence, right? I don't know exactly how this works in Israel, but I just thought it was interesting that former prime minister actually could be indicted and convicted and sentenced to 6 years in prison for bribery. They paid off his brother on a land deal. Typical Whitewater stuff, right? Doesn't matter who he killed in Gaza. This Whitewater scandal stuff. But that's all right. Screw him. In other news, Austin cop indicted. Talked about this a little bit on the show yesterday. And don't worry, I'm going to get back to Ukraine all that a little bit later, but I want to talk about this. Kleinert is his name. And I wanted to point out that this article in the Austin American Statesman, mystatesman.com, Kleinert's indictment draws strong reaction from both sides. Now, remember when we spoke with Mr. Michael Bell Sr. on the show last week, and the cops had killed his son, and he had gotten a law passed in Wisconsin mandating some kind of external investigation anytime the cops kill somebody or somebody dies in their custody. Which seems so commonsensical, and yet it is so unique and incredible. Well, what was I going to say about the Bell thing? Let's see, cops that murder people and accountability and something. Anyway, great interview. Anyway, this guy Kleiner, oh, I know what it was. It was in that case, this guy Michael Bell, he created such a perfect PR storm that he was able to get the police unions in Wisconsin on his side so that they could posture in the following fashion. We are clean, virtuous cops who are only your security force here to protect you from crime. And so we are happy to have independent investigations of killings by police officials, because after all, police officers, because after all, we were only ever doing the right thing anyway, and if any cop was ever doing the wrong thing, well, then we wouldn't want to have his back anyway. So, we'd be happy to see you prosecute him if he deserves to be prosecuted. It was, he set it up so that politically, that was the only position that they could take. Don't you guys want to distance yourselves from the bad cops? In fact, maybe he even really went so far as, I don't know if he really said this or not, it sounded almost like he knew which were the better and which were the worse jurisdictions in his state, and he kind of turned them against each other. Hey, aren't you guys tired of County X department making you look like a bunch of scumbags all the time? This is your chance to stick it to them and differentiate yourselves from them and, you know, maybe get some more money for yourselves, that kind of thing. Something. He got them on the right side of it. He got them out in front of the parade. The police unions, saying that they support checks and balances and independent investigations of deaths at police hands. Well, down here in Texas, they got the Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas. That's the cop lobby. Sure hope no one comes to execute me tonight. I'm not a criminal or anything. I'm just a critic, which is different. But they're rallying behind Detective Kleinert, because as far as they're concerned, if a cop killed somebody, good. And if a cop feels like killing you, your obligation is to lay down and die. And if a cop ever gets in trouble for killing somebody, their only objective is to help get him sprung. To protect the police officer's priority to kill whoever he wants. To kill people. And I guess there was a time, and I don't know how they ever convinced people to take it this way, but where people used to defer to the cops and give them the benefit of the doubt as though somehow they had proven their legitimacy, their honesty, their trustworthiness. And only ever, maybe they sometimes beat somebody's ass, but only when they really, really deserved it. But no, now we hate you. It ain't the criminals or their sympathizers. It's all decent people who consider the police to be criminals because they are, and they've overplayed their hand, their PR hand. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at APSRadioNews.com, at DailyPaulRadio.com, AnomalyRadio.com. You writing all this down? ScottHorton.org/listen, and ScottHorton.org/chat. And in the chat room now, we're having a discussion here about Woodrow Wilson and how everything in the world is his fault. If you're not familiar, the thing of it is, very quickly, World War I was a stalemate. It was over until America got involved. And by getting involved, that tipped the balance of power so far in favor of the British, the French, that they were able to soundly defeat. Well, I don't know. They were able to force the Germans into surrendering under the 14 points, and then they screwed them. And they stole all their territories, and they completely bankrupted them with all the war debts and obligations they heaped on them. And it completely destabilized their society and created the opportunity for the Nazi party to rise to power. And the beer hall putsch took place amidst the hyperinflation, the original attempt of Hitler to seize power. And And anyway, point of it is, that's where Nazism comes from, is the aftermath of World War One, and the average German schmo's agreement with Hitler that, yeah, somebody ought to avenge what happened to us. And so, go ahead. That was his mandate. And anyway, problems there for a lot of people, you know, as a result. And of course, at the same time, Wilson's intervention, his bribes and aid to Russia convinced Kerensky, the post-Tsarist revolutionary government leader, the prime minister of Russia, to stay in the war. And that, of course, was his fatal mistake, because not only did it undermine any support for him as the leader, but it also made sure that whatever was left of the Russian army was far from Moscow when Lenin and Trotsky, on their fourth try, seized power, what, 6 months later after Kerensky had come to power in October of 1917, and thus the first communist regime on earth came to power and helped spread communism around the world, which helped kill so many. And then, of course, the clash between the Nazi and communist powers there. There's your democide numbers right there. There's your 175 million killed by these totalitarians. And then, of course, it also gave the British and the French the mandate, so-called, quote-unquote, mandate, to seize the former Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and keep it for themselves. They expanded the British Empire by 1 million square miles, their victory in World War One, because of America. So, because of American intervention in World War One, which is already the most horrible thing ever, American intervention, prolonging it and tilting the balance the way they did, created Nazism, created communism, created World War II, created the Cold War, created the American Empire, right down to Guantanamo Bay in your neighborhood. Now you get it. It's all Woodrow Wilson's fault. Simple as that. Yeah, oh, the Middle East mandate, Israel, all of it's tied up in it. So there you go. And but then he asks, so is dang on Obama our Wilson? No, Bush. Bush Jr. Boy, that Iraq war. And it was so obvious at the time. Oh my God, it was the slowest motion train wreck since Hitler invaded Poland. Oh no, wait, don't come back. Oh God, please stop. No, oh, you don't have to do this. But if you do, it's going to be really bad. And they did it anyway. And we're going to be suffering consequences of the invasion of Iraq for decades to come, for generations. Right when things could have been better. You know, when they really could have been different. And anyway, that's the worst thing ever, man. Look at what's going on in Syria right now. I don't know if the UN is right, but the UN is saying 9 million refugees? 9 million refugees. Talked about that with Patrick Coburn on the show a little bit yesterday, and I wonder if maybe the answer there is because so many people in Syria were already refugees, Iraqi refugees, and Palestinian refugees. And so once the war started, internal and external displacement, just forget about it, right? Never mind the people who just starved to death in their camp, in the Yarmouk camp, or wherever they're stuck in the first place. That thing in Syria is horrifying, man. And, you know, we don't get much coverage of it at all because we don't have Americans, you know, the 3rd Infantry Division on the ground there stuck in the middle of it like during the Iraq War, but it is America's war. And it is absolutely horrible. And if America was not intervening in that war, it would have been long over by now. It would have been a victory for the Ba'athist regime, which is not necessarily good, but I don't know. You'd have to kind of argue it's better than this. I mean, the opposite of a Ba'athist victory is not a victory for the Sunni uprising, which would have its own problems, but the opposite of a Ba'athist victory is just war like this forever. This is the stated policy of the Israeli and the U.S. government at this point, at least off the record, sometimes on the record, that yes, we would just have all the sides in Syria fight each other as long as possible. They told McClatchy newspapers last week that we're arming up the rebels with TOW missiles now, anti-tank missiles, because we, and not because we want to help the rebels win, but we just want to make sure that they continue to exist. That there stays a war. That's horrible, man. I don't know. It's funny, the unreality of it, right? It's just like with any of this stuff. Yeah, we're invading Africa for kidnapped girls. Yeah, we're crying the world's largest tears and playing the world's largest violin for the poor Crimeans being annexed by the Russians. And let's tell any lie over any subject. Boy, and speaking of which, you know what I should have done? I should have played this for you guys, man. I should have played the whole audio of this on the show today. I guess I could in the last segment, man. Why not? I don't know. This thing in the New York Times about Agent Orange. And you know about Agent Orange. And if you don't know about Agent Orange, basically it's like this. Anyone who resisted the American invasion of South Vietnam was labeled a communist and a member of the Khmer Rouge and not a nationalist resistor to foreign colonial occupation, but an ideological communist beholden to, you know, Marxist collectivism and Ho Chi Minh. And so they didn't have the right to resist. And the solution was to empty the countryside of people, like one of Stalin's five-year plans, and force them into these, you know, new so-called cities, basically giant refugee camps. And it was Samuel Huntington's idea. And it was the most horrible war. This is the most horrible thing. Read Nick Turse's book, Kill Anything That Moves, about Vietnam. And that's the true face of the U.S. government right there, man. These people care so much about kidnapped little girls. And this is their true face, too. Look at this thing in the New York Times. It's a partnership with some other journalism. I don't know how, some other journalists, I don't know how they got away with it. Clyde Haberman from the Retro Report for the New York Times about Agent Orange. Agent Orange's long legacy for Vietnam and veterans. Here, I'll put the link in the chat room. If anybody wants to go to antiwar.com/chat, we'll have the link in there for you. And it's a great little documentary here. And what's the bottom line, Scott Horton? Cut to the chase. Well, how do you force all the Vietnamese peasants out of the countryside and into these Bantustans? Well, you spray them with chemical weapons. In this case, dioxin to kill, you know, like killing the buffalo to starve the Indians. Will just destroy all of the vegetative growth in the countryside. We'll just kill all their crops and kill all their jungles and kill all their canopy cover for their resistance. And the ones who are born deformed generations later, screw them. That was the government policy. That was the Johnson-Nixon regime's policy. And the other part of their policy, surprise, was that when veterans complained about their horrible illnesses and effects and poisonings from dioxin, never mind those poor subhuman Vietnamese who don't even have the right to complain. But when the soldiers complained, the U.S. government's answer for decades was, screw you, you're lying, you're making it up, there's no science that says so, we don't know what you're talking about. It's not true. And denied them the care and their obligation to the people that they drafted into service and then poisoned with chemical weapons. Now, I'm from here too. I don't like it any more than you do. I would prefer it if America was the America of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and what all that is supposed to mean. It just isn't so. Oh, good, and we're going to have dead air instead of Fox News again. Well, I thought maybe that would be fixed, but I guess not. So don't worry about it, because what's going to happen is I'm just going to play some Beastie Boys for 6 minutes or something. How about that?
Yeah.
I like the Beastie Boys.
Make the voice more clear. Clear, more clear. Jungle, jungle. Merlin. Production Company. Blackhawk International and Branch present. All been going around. Have you seen Mr. Brown?
one quick note here, y'all. Remember we talked about how the Israeli government called Jeff Stein an anti-Semite for documenting Israeli spying on America in two different stories in Newsweek? Well, now in the new documents published by Glenn Greenwald in conjunction with his book today, on page 40 of the new documents, you see that Israel, according to a national intelligence estimate, is in third place for most aggressive spying on the United States of America. Ooh, that hive of anti-Semitism there at the National Intelligence Council. Whatever motive could they have to tell such lies? Yeah, just like Jeff Stein's anti-Semitism, too. It's unbelievable.
But silver and gold, silver and gold have I none. But in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk, rise up and walk, rise up and walk, rise up and walk. A weeping time, weeping time and weeping time, weeping time and creeping time. Reap what you sow, rapping coming from your weeping mind, and all that I reap is mine. Cannot reap what is mine. Say. Was in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, black Russian cigarette, kindly weed and ganja, marijuana, lung spray. Rise up and
Fox News at the top of the hour, which can only be good for your overall constitution. All right, well, good deal. We got Brendan O'Neill online. He's from spikedonline.com, and he's got this great one. Quit your crying, Cameron. You boosted Boko Haram. Welcome back to the show. Brendan, how are you doing?
Hi, Scott. I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. I love any article that begins with, quit your crying.
The West bears a lot of responsibility for this group in the first place.
Well, I just can't imagine that that could be true. Okay, no. Let me put it this way. I can imagine that's true, but I don't know it's true, so show me.
Well, Boko Haram, as we all know now, is a group that has been based in Nigeria since 2002. It was a peaceful organization up till 2009, and that's when it started having some run-ins with the Nigerian authorities, which were largely down, I must say, to the Nigerian authorities' mishandling of this.
There's a guy in Somalia who once went to Yemen and played on the monkey bars over there with the bad guys in Yemen, and then he came back where he shook hands with a Libyan who knows a guy who used to be roommates with a dude who had gone down to Mali where he had met someone from Boko Haram who had traveled up to Mali from Nigeria. And so, therefore, we get to have a drone war in Nigeria now because by the transitive property of this guy knew a guy who played on the monkey bars in Yemen, then that means...
regime. And we knew that this would happen. The Mali government said constantly in international circles in 2011, it said, if you attack Libya, it's going to have disastrous consequences for us. And that's exactly what happened. And it's that war in Mali, which is the main arena in which Libyan arms are passed around amongst al-Qaeda-linked groups, and in which Boko Haram fighters start to learn new skills and to get new weapons. So my argument is not that, you know, there is a kind of tangential link between this guy over here and that guy over there, but rather that there is a systematic effort by the West to dismantle states in Africa, and that is creating these new vacuums in which stateless groups like Boko Haram can thrive. So my argument is the West needs to get the hell out of these parts of the world rather than do anything else.
Right. Well, and of course, the reason that Al-Qaeda in Yemen is anything more than a house full of Al-Hazmi's father-in-law and his friends or whatever. The group's going to end up meeting back around at Uganda where they're still supposedly hunting Joseph Kony.
Absolutely, and this is the thing that no one in Western government circles wants to talk about, which is that terrorism has got worse and worse in tandem with the war on terror. I mean, you can measure it. The amount of terrorism there is in different parts of the world, the amount of instability there is has grown with the war on terror, and it's not a coincidence. And I think what we're seeing now is Western militaries effectively trying to firefight problems that have behaved like sheep on the issue of Libya. I mean, the vast majority of MPs in our parliament voted for the attack on Libya. They didn't even think about it. I think it's like something 550 out of 600 or something like that voted for this attack, didn't think through the consequences, didn't ask if there was a long-term plan, didn't ask who Cameron and Obama and Sarkozy planned to install in Gaddafi's place. They didn't ask any of these questions. They didn't ask any awkward questions about the National Transitional Council in Libya, which we now have in the argument with people to keep saying to them, look, these were the consequences of the Libya war, and that's why we need to be much more skeptical of intervention in the future.
Yeah. Well, you know, just in the past few weeks, I've been talking with Patrick Coburn and with Jonathan Lande about this new State Department terrorism report that's come out. And, you know, we've just been covering the Libya intervention and the results, and also Syria, of course, and the spreading of the consequences of the Iraq war and the restarting of the civil war there. And it seems like the part that goes unmentioned most of the time is just how dangerous these guys really are. And you cannot reason with the Bin Ladenite suicide bombers. I mean, the best thing that you could do is, as Wolfowitz would say, drain the swamp, only do it right by stopping killing people, supporting revolutions, and supporting dictators and whatever else, and try to let that resentment dry up. But you sure as hell can't fight it the way they're fighting it. They're just spreading it around, and it reminds me of what William Lynn says about fourth-generation warfare, about how this is important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, guys. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome back to the show. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Brendan O'Neill, editor of SpikedOnline.com. Quit your crying, Cameron. You boosted Boko Haram. He writes at SpikedOnline.com, and on this front, and their future, our future with them in this world. I mean, how is this going to be? What's going to happen?
It is pretty worrying, and, you know, as you mentioned, ISIS in Syria and parts of Iraq, I mean, they make Al-Qaeda look like a tea party in comparison, you know, not the tea party, but a kind of polite little picnic tea party, because they are a completely unhinged group, and they now control parts of Syria. And what I think this kind of lawlessness, this kind of creation of new law, 1999 speech in Chicago, which all the Bush regime waiting in the wings thought was the greatest speech ever given, in which he said the state is over and the onus is on the international community to interfere in states when they're doing bad things. So the West itself has completely devalued the idea of the state. And then the second thing is that it's actually acted on that by constantly launching wars over the past 10 to 15 years that have just swept aside governments, swept aside in
all to everybody for the audio problems. I don't know what the hell's wrong. Some say it's on my end. It sounds like your telephone is crackly to me, but they say that I sound terrible. I don't know. Anyway, so hopefully, you know, I mean, I can hear you fine, and I don't hear anything wrong in the room, so I don't know. I guess we'll just keep going and hope that it's okay. But I'm sorry to go back to the beginning here, but could you tell us a little bit more about who Boko Haram is, where they come from, what their grievances are? I mean, I know that Nigeria...
Islamic group, and that's a trend I think we see a lot these days, where groups start off as having local grievances, fighting against a particular government or party, but then kind of inevitably become globalized jihadi lunatics. And I think that is part of the process of the undermining of the state, the way in which when there are no state structures, no idea of state sovereignty or national borders, you inevitably have the rise of these groups that are post-border, which are cross-border, which see themselves as being global
enterprise. Farmer crazy, huh? Well, let's make an enemy out of you then, if we can, for ourselves.
Yeah, and I think the contrast between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, when they were both in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, is really interesting, because the Taliban was very locally focused. It was obsessed with the local, with cohering Afghanistan, because it had become such an unstable state after the Afghan-Soviet war. So they were just obsessed with making it a stable state. And then you had Al-Qaeda, who were constantly focused on the global, constantly focused on the great Satan and you know, these huge enemies that it wanted to launch spectacular attacks against. And it was obsessed with media. You know, the Taliban never did any media at all, but the Al-Qaeda were constantly giving out press releases and videos and so on. And what we've seen is that the Al-Qaeda mindset has won. It's the Al-Qaeda mindset which has survived the test of time. The old localized fundamentalist Taliban mindset is kind of on the wane, whereas what we're seeing is the growth of more and more of these groups that are obsessed with talking in global terms. And to me, it's a mirror image of humanitarian intervention, actually, because those so-called humanitarians of the 90s also saw themselves as global warriors against evil, you know, the Serbs or whoever else that got on their nerves. And now we have the mirror image in these global Islamic groups that see themselves as warriors against the evil West. It's the flip reversal of the same process of being post-state and post-borders, I think.
Yep. I've worn this joke out, but I don't know if I ever used it on you, Brennan. I'm a reverse truther. I think that Bin Laden was the secret Illuminati master controller of Bush and Cheney all along. And that instead of them having him do 9/11 for them, he had them react exactly the way he wanted. Take as much advantage as you possibly can, you know, big, tough cream puffs, you. And they did. And Obama's really just followed up on the same disastrous policy since.
Yeah, I think there's no question that this Western intervention plays into certain groups' hands. Firstly, because it allows them, it entertains their idea that they are in some great cosmological battle with the West, you know, good versus evil. But also because, as you say, it creates precisely the lawless zones in which these groups can operate, you know, where they can do their own thing, train their guys, smuggle their weapons, and boost their influence. And, you know, Syria is a really interesting place for us to watch, because as a result of the kind of Western goading of the Assad regime and Western support for the oppositional forces, we've seen the creation there of vast swathes of land that are now not governed, and where ISIS is really making gains. And that could have a destabilizing impact across the Middle East, and just as the war in Libya had a destabilizing impact across Africa. You know, the West is destroying large parts of the world, and I think we need to kick up more of a fuss about that.
Absolutely. All right, well, I'm sorry we're way over time, and I got to let you go, but thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Brennan.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Cheers.
That's the way every interview ends. I got more questions. He's got more answers. We got no more time. We got to go. Brendan O'Neill, Spiked Online. Quit your crying, Cameron. You boosted Boko Haram. Everybody go take a look at Spiked Online. Great group of guys over there. Oh, Jesus. We'll be right back with Trevor Tim in just a second.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Got Trevor Tim on the line. He writes for The Guardian. He works for the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Boy, I can't talk today. Only had half a pot of coffee instead of a whole one. I got Trevor Tim on the line. He's writing for The Guardian now, and he's at the Freedom of the Press Foundation, where Glenn Greenwald and Dan Ellsberg and Edward Snowden and John Cusack also sit on the board of directors there. Welcome back to the show, Trevor. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Really appreciate your time on the show, as always. And I know you must be very busy today. Today's Greenwald Day in America. It ought to be an official holiday, I guess. His new book's come out, and it's got a ton of new stuff in it, and I don't have my copy yet. I guess, can you go ahead and tell us what are the biggest headlines coming out of Glenn Greenwald's new book, other than the fact, as we already discussed earlier on the show, that Glenn has posted all of the documents included in the book online for people to peruse?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, first of all, the most complete story yet of how the Snowden, about how Edward Snowden originally came to Glenn and how him and Laura Poitras ended up reporting the story of the decade. I mean, it's just a riveting read from the first chapter when you find out that, you know, Edward Snowden was first trying to contact him with a pseudonym and trying to get him to set up email encryption, which Glenn almost didn't do. And then the fact that Glenn almost lost the story of the decade because he actually wouldn't set up email encryption or chat encryption. But, you know, there's definitely new revelations in the book, including parts about how the NSA has intercepted internet routers and servers through the mail and then opened the boxes, put back doors in them, sealed them back up, and then sent them off to foreign customers. You know, that's
even a picture of NSA employees actually doing the breaking into the package, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably been the biggest headline so far. But then there's just all sorts of new and interesting slides that show all of the things that the NSA will do to analyze the information coming in and just the enormous numbers of information. You know, I think one report said that a single unit inside NSA searched something like 97 billion emails and 124 billion phone calls. So they collected data on that many just in a one-month period. And that was only a single unit. So, you know, it just goes to show you how enormous the surveillance state has really gotten. And the fact that this was done in almost complete secrecy up until 10 months ago.
You know, it seems like if you just said, you know, to a real computer genius comic book guy kind of a character, like, hey, what is your absolute worst nightmare for the ultimate capability of the NSA? What all they're able to get, and how well they're able to process it all and that kind of thing. It sort of seems like anything that guy could, and I pick someone like that because they know enough about computers to be able to imagine what to me is an unknown unknown, right? To them could be a known unknown. What kind of interception and deciphering capability can be applied to all that's intercepted and all that kind of thing? It sort of seems like the ultimate lesson here is that anything that could be imagined on that level is what they're doing, and that if there's any news here, it's that, surprise, there's actually a limit to how far they can go in one circumstance or the other. Otherwise, it sounds like every electronic communication on Earth belongs to them. What am I missing?
Well, I mean, I don't think you're missing much. I think that... You
damn,
know,
I thought you were going to say, come on, Scott, but no.
I mean, I wish you were, but I, you know, I think that the stories of the last 10 months have really changed the way that we, you know, see privacy on the internet, and the fact that not just the NSA is probably trying to invade our privacy, but intelligence agencies all over the world. It just happens to be that the NSA has more money and more resources than most.
Right. All right. So, now, is there anything that really stood out at you so far? Are you reading the book? How far into it are you? Anything that's really shocking to you?
I'm just a few chapters in. You know, I think people who are, you know, pay attention to this story day to day, There might not necessarily be tons of new information in the book, but the slides for people who have been following it closely are probably the most interesting part. And like I said, you know, they go through all sorts of ways that they analyze and search this information.
Let me ask you this. I've had a real hard time because I'm not a computer genius type at all. I mean, the best thing I know about being a computer genius is how to get you on the show, if I'm lucky. So I've had the hardest time understanding all this stuff. I mean, in principle, okay, they tap the router. I know what that means. You know, they add a mirror to the fiber optic cable. Okay, that makes sense to me. This kind of thing, breaking into this or that or tracking searches. But when it comes to all the different code names and all the different methods and really how to categorize in my mind how, all the different programs and how they work together and that kind of thing, it becomes a very jumbled mess. I can't do it. But so the question then is, when I am done reading Greenwald's book, will I finally understand this stuff? Like I finally have read enough of it that now I'll have a more coherent picture of what I'm looking at instead of just this jumble of threatening ones and zeros.
I mean, I think the code words confuse a lot of people, including the reporters, you know, the ProPublica reporters who reported that huge story about 6 months ago about the NSA trying to break common forms of encryption, you know, talks about how he had to lock himself in a room basically for a month and a half just to figure out the language and the code words the NSA was using in these documents. You know, it's almost like they are using a separate language when they talk about these things. And, you know, one part of the NSA refers to something under one code word that the other part of the NSA has a different code word for. So I think it does get quite confusing for a lot of people. And, you know, I hope the book can clarify a lot of what's going on for people who might be confused. Mm.
All right, so Greenwald says in this new interview with GQ magazine that, well, and he's been saying that he's saving the best for last. In this case, he compares it to a fireworks show and says, well, you know, I'm building up to the finale and that kind of thing. Good old Glenn, I like that guy. So, the thing is I like speculating. And you know what I think it is I think it is that the NSA knows everything about every senator and every former and or potential presidential candidate, any influential member of the House of Representatives, maybe even in the state houses and the state governors, that the NSA wages a full-scale information warfare operation against the elected Democratic representatives of the people of the United States of America in order to keep them all in line. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, if that was true, it would be blatantly illegal and unconstitutional. You know, the NSA likes to play on the very, very outer edges of the law, and they try to get secret reinterpretations of the law done by the FISA court, but they are very careful not to do anything blatantly illegal because they know once that happens, they'll be shut down, and so they use this, you know, these broad laws that they get Congress to pass so they could do pretty much whatever they want on foreign soil and anything coming into the U.S. and then metadata in the U.S. But if they actually have content of communications of U.S. senators or people running for office, then they're going to be in a lot of trouble. And that's going to mean the end of the NSA and criminal indictments. So, you know, I can't comment on the what the story could possibly be that Glenn is talking about. But if it's something like that, then it would be truly shocking.
Do you know what it is? Or do you have a reasonable suspicion of what's the big deal? You don't have to tell me, but just tell me if you think you know.
I mean, just what Glenn was talking about, actually, if you watch him on the Colbert Report last night, he talked about that there it may have something to do with what the NSA is doing inside the United States. But, you know, beyond that, I'm not really sure. So we will see.
I wonder if this could relate back to that conversation on CNN that Greenwald was covering at The Guardian just before the Snowden leaks began to break, where that guy was talking about the Boston attack and saying we can go back and rewind all of this punk's phone calls and see who he was talking to and what he was doing. And then the needle scratched off the record and everybody went, wait, what did you just say? You can go back and, well, why would he be recorded? Are you saying you were recording him? Are you saying you're recording everybody or what? And then the answers stopped coming. And then that story kind of died because, holy crap, the entire Snowden revelations started coming out. Makes me wonder if that one country where they're intercepting all the phone calls was this one.
I mean, it's possible that guy, first of all, we're not sure how credible that guy was in the first place, but it's possible he was talking about phone calls going into and out of the United States from certain countries, because, you know, like you said, we know that there's at least one country where they record all phone calls, so that means naturally that if somebody's calling the U.S. from that country, then that phone call is getting recorded. Like I said, if they are recording completely domestic phone calls, that would just be an outrageous and unbelievable violation of the law and the Constitution, and that people will go to jail or should go to jail immediately if that's true.
Well, see, this is why I like talking to you. You understand these issues so well, and you have such a level head against all of my speculations. But that's part of having a government of, basically total power and total secrecy, where there's not much accountability beyond the public's imagination, you know? Or we don't really get to know what they're doing beyond what we can guess. So, anyway, thanks again for informing our opinion, Trevor. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Trevor Tim, everybody. He's at the Freedom of the Press Foundation and the Guardian. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. All right, well, I got to talk about Ukraine and Israel in one segment. I guess I can do that. Man, this thing over at Electronic Intifada, I don't even like thinking about this, much less talking about this or whatever. It's important to cover. Got to cover it, but what a nightmare, man. It's a nightmare. Over at Electronic Intifada, Abu Abunima, his blog, Ali Abunima. I'm sorry, I don't know how to say it. I called him Abu just now. It's Ali Abunima, I think. Children describe torture in Israeli solitary confinement. The only thing breaking about this is that it's a new report published by an NGO about the same thing that everybody's been knowing goes on all the time and has been this whole time. And just listen to this. This is where the money that was taken out of your paycheck before you get it on Friday, when you look at the gross and the net and you go, oh my God, this is where that money went, right here. A rising proportion of Palestinian children arrested by Israeli occupation forces are subjected to solitary confinement, harsh interrogations, and ill treatment, amounting to torture, according to a report published today by the Defense of Children International Palestine section. Quote, in 21.4% of cases recorded by DCI Palestine in 2013, children detained in the Israeli military detention system reported undergoing solitary confinement as part of the interrogation process. This represents an increase of 2% from 2012, a press release accompanying the report states. DCI Palestine collected 98 sworn affidavits from Palestinian children aged 12 to 17 in 2013. The disturbing findings in the report are based on 40 solitary confinement cases documented in 2013. Night arrests. In the vast majority of cases, 34 out of 40 children are arrested from their beds. Quote, children report that heavily armed Israeli soldiers arrest them in violent circumstances during night raids on their family homes, the report says. Their children are often woken up by the sound of Israeli soldiers banging on the front door before a family member opens the door or the soldiers force their way in, storming the home. Then the occupation soldiers gather all the occupants of the house, regardless of their age, in one room or outside, and then demand identification. Generally, the entire home will be searched during the raid. Once a child's identity has been verified from his identification card, his family will be informed that he must accompany the soldiers. Blindfolded. Children or their parents are almost never informed of the accusations. And, the report says, this moment is most likely the last time the family will see their child until he appears in a military court following an unknown period of solitary confinement and interrogation. Once the soldiers have identified the child, his hands will be tied with plastic cords, mostly behind his back, and will be blindfolded and led to a military vehicle. More than half the children reported some form of physical violence during the arrest and transfer to interrogation facilities, including Petah Tikva Detention Center, Kishon Detention Center near Haifa, or Shikma Prison near Ashkelon. These facilities are under control of the Israeli Prison Service and or the Shin Bet Secret Police. Al-Jalem is among the several Israeli facilities equipped by the international incarceration profiteering firm G4S. On average, children spent 10 days in solitary confinement, but children have been held for up to 29 days in isolation. Children held at Kishon described being locked in a small windowless cell lit 24 hours a day by a dim bulb. There they slept on a concrete bed on the floor, a thin mattress. The forcing confessions, and we're talking about kids who threw a rock at a tank occupying their land for 50 years. They're forced to sit in a low metal chair with their hands and feet cuffed to the chair for hours. Well, why do they hate us? Because we, Americans, our government, with our money, supports the Israelis' war crimes all day, every day. That's why. Can you imagine if America occupied Baghdad for 50 years, doing night raids for 50 years, unending occupation? Oh, and moving in white guys from the suburbs to eventually, in slow motion, conquer the land and displace the people who live there? Can you imagine if the Israeli military came and did this to your son? Twelve and 13 and 14-year-old boys. If they're lucky, they don't get electroshock torture, just locked in solitary confinement in a dungeon, chained to a chair to the floor. Like some Far Side cartoon of the Middle Ages, only with a little kid, instead of just some poor schlub. And this is standard operating procedure for the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. This is how they treat the Palestinians. You know, just yesterday, in fact, go to my Twitter feed, / Scott Horton Show, and you'll see I retweeted where Max Blumenthal was mocking the Israelis for, oh yeah, the Israelis are going to go help find the kidnapped Nigerian girls because they're experts at kidnapping children. And then he links to a YouTube video of the cops, the military, the IDF in the occupied West Bank kidnapping a little boy. A couple of them. They're like 8 years old. 7, 8 years old. And rewind back to the night raids. The IDF as NKVD or SS you know, nightmares, boogeymen. Every little kid in the West Bank has to be afraid to go to sleep. For real. Not for imagined silly nightmares that don't worry, everything's going to be fine. But yeah, no, the IDF just might come and abduct you from your bed and take you off to be tortured. Really. Sorry, son. That's just something we all have to learn to live with, being West Bankians. We're the property of the Israelis, and they can do whatever they want with us, including, yes, come and kidnap you and torture you, you know, if they feel like it. That's the reality of the Israeli occupation. For 50 years. For longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. Yeah, don't worry. The next time when Intifada 3 or 4 or 5 or whichever it is now breaks out, we'll be sure to understand that Islam makes Muslims crazy for some reason. And even the Christian Arabs, why Islam drives them crazy too. Why, look at them. Why would they throw a rock at a tank other than their crazy Islam makes them do it? And TV won't even tell you. Oh, they'll tell you the poor Israeli Jews are beset on all sides with the crazies, just like the zombies in that Brad Pitt movie trying to climb over the wall and harm our helpless, beloved Israeli democratic allies. Oh, why won't they ever stop? Without ever explaining that their territory on the other side of the wall is occupied by Israel. That isn't the country next door. That slave land where the half-humans live with no rights. And never will have any either. Where the IDF can come and kidnap little children out of their beds in the middle of the night. And their parents cannot do, can never, will never be able to do a thing about it. How would you like to live like that? That's what you pay the Israelis to do to the Palestinians every day. Kidnap and torture their children. That's what you do. That's where the money that comes out of your check goes. Straight to the paychecks of Israeli child torturers. Fact. Get it straight. Oh yes, poor Israel. Beset on all sides. By their slaves. Well, yes, we have the wolf by the ears. We can neither safely hold him nor let him go. So I guess we'll just keep holding them, huh, guys? Poor Israeli victims. Innocent victims of those they enslave and oppress, whose children they torture.